Welcome to Art If, the podcast about art, life, and everything in between.
Welcome back. All right. This is episode 16 of the Art If podcast. I'm Hattie.
And I'm Yossi. In this week's gallery, we talk about art and reality, how the lines between art and reality are increasingly blurred, and how art has the power to dictate the realities we see.
And then we interviewed documentary filmmaker and photographer Andy Sarjahani.
And as always, we end with a provocation for you, the listener. This provocation asks you to look for something very specific and snag a photo of it.
If you love this podcast, and we know you do,
yes,
subscribe. Subscribe to get those latest episodes and minisodes. Just hit that subscribe button. Do it right now. It only takes 1 second. You could have been done with it already. So, art and reality. Do we have anything to say about that?
Well, I mean, I think that in terms of our gallery topics, it's the relationship that is perhaps like most entrenched in all art, right? Art as a form of reality or as a reflection of reality, even if it's abstract, versus, right? There's blurred lines between art and reality.
Yeah, like, I mean, the theater, we always say art is an imitation of life, or is it the other way around?
But I've heard both as like colloquialisms, right?
Yeah.
Life is an imitation of art.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It was an interesting one because I feel like a case could be made for us bringing anything into this gallery, which is not the case for, you know, any other ones.
When you said the topic, I knew immediately what I was going to do.
Oh, wow. Okay.
It's the first one I think that I've been like 100% sure from the moment that we had a topic, I knew exactly what I was going to do with no equivocation.
Oh, that's amazing.
So I am doing the art of data visualization.
Wow. Okay. Amazing. Like graphs and stuff you see in newspapers?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
This came up for me because recently in some Facebook group I'm a part of that I hate being a part of. Well, they post somebody in there that I do not know posted two graphs about coronavirus statistics. And they were both bar graphs.
Okay.
And they both used a gradation of blue to represent number of cases. So
based on date then, like at this date, yeah. I see. Okay.
And so in both bar graphs, they kind of chart a very similar arc. But when you looked closely at the details, in the first graph, light blue represented up to 500 or whatever. In the second bar graph, which was like later in the year, the light blue represented up to 2,000. And so like right, like 500 compared to 2,000, but they looked exactly the same visually. So I
interesting
started thinking about the truth of these graphs and how we have access to these visual aesthetics to tell these stories. And what are the stories we're telling and what is the reality behind the data and what's the relationship between those aesthetics and the reality of the data?
Cool. And not just cool, but really important and informative in this current moment.
First of all, data visualization begins with cartography.
Okay.
That's sort of
map making.
Yeah, map making. That's the first sort of, that'd be what they call the first visual representation of some form of data. Charting where things are, how big they are in relationship to one another, etc. This was striking to me because of Google Maps and how integrated that is into our lives.
Mm-hmm.
But we were driving the other day and I don't know exactly what happened, but like there was like an update or some sort of bug, either one, I don't know. But all of the roads were blue. And like the road you're supposed to follow is supposed to be blue. And it was dark blue and all of the other freeway roads, this was like an intersecting freeway that was just a hot fucking mess. They were all like light blue and the one we were supposed to be on was dark blue, but you couldn't see it because there was so much other blue around. It was just chaos.
Oh my gosh. What is that Bob Dylan album, Tangled Up in Blue?
So the point of that story is that data visualizations are intended to give us information really quickly, right? It's supposed to be simple and straightforward. Mm-hmm. And one of the videos I watched made the argument that we evolved our visual sense in order to make very quick decisions. So we receive information from it very fast, and we process that information quickly and make important decisions very quickly based on visual information. And the example the person in the video gave was if you're out in the savanna and the grass is moving, you're like, oh, are those moving vertical lines just wind in the grass, or is that a tiger coming to eat me?
Right. Okay. I see.
So we have instinctual reactions to this visual information that we're getting.
Well, and like bees, we like see markers, and that's how we like make our way somewhere too.
Yeah.
Right? Okay.
Yeah. We also react to the aesthetics of these graphs and information as much as we react to the data. So if they're visually appealing, we're very inclined to pay more attention to them than if they are ugly.
Right. Who wants to look at an ugly bar graph?
But the point of this is to take information that would normally take you hours and hours to sort through and make it digestible in literally an instant.
Okay. That seems like an impossible task, but all right.
One of the other videos I watched suggested that good data visualization should be in the service of learning something, not in the service of confirming something.
How would you make that distinguish? Like, how would you make that distinction visually?
There are different kinds of graphs that represent different kinds of information. There's what we call exploratory graphs and explanatory graphs. And exploratory graphs help show relationships between things that you might not have seen.
Okay.
And explanatory graphs determine the reasons behind that relationship. So they're more about telling a particular kind of story. And so this has to do with the aesthetics that we choose to use and even things like the way we title a graph.
Okay.
So you can make a graph that confirms something that you already believe by distorting the aesthetics of the graph.
Right. That's what I'm curious about. Like, visually, like, what would that look like differently?
So there are four things that are really at our disposal in terms of representing this information visually. Position. So the relationship between things, especially if you have like an X and Y axis.
Uh-huh.
We're trained to, at least in the United States, Western Europe, we're trained to read left to right. Mm-hmm. We have this sort of ingrained hierarchy between high and low. And so when we see things in positions, we automatically make associations and assumptions about that relationship between those positions.
Okay.
Position is also the thing that we encode with the greatest degree of accuracy. So,
okay.
So we have position, we have color, we have shape, we have size. And when they've done studies to determine how accurately you understand something, if we're comparing the lengths of two lines, and I say, is this line a fourth the size of this line, or is it a 16th the size of this line? We can understand length better than we can understand the area of a circle, for example.
I see. Okay.
But we position is the thing that we encode with the most accuracy, followed by length, slope, angle, area, volume, and color.
I feel like I'm in geometry class.
I know.
Or a trig, I don't know.
So color is the thing that we encode with the least amount of accuracy, especially in terms of the color name itself. And part of the reason is because we can't order colors. When we're looking at position, left and right, right, the thing that's on the right is farther in the future. So we like automatically order those things. Mm. But if you have red, yellow, green, and orange, there's no order. There's no there's no relationship to put them in any sort of organizational order, unless maybe the rainbow, but even that isn't like that strong.
No. Okay.
With color, we have two other factors that we can use to create some sense of order, and that's value and saturation. So value being light to dark mm-hmm. and saturation being muted to bright. Mm-hmm. So you could have like a scale that goes from gray to red and it would get increasingly more red, or you could have a scale that goes from pink to red. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have those values and those suggest some sense of order. I saw a graph recently though. I guess I've been thinking about data visualization for a long time because I saw this graph like over a year ago. I think it was last summer. It was a graph that was demonstrating the correlation between temperature and socioeconomic status.
Like so, climate?
Yeah. So in urban areas, the areas of the city with a lower socioeconomic status have a higher temperature.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it has to do with things like higher SES classes have more access to parks and trees and landscaping.
Green areas, right. Yeah,
which help reduce the temperature. So there's more shade. They're also often further away from industrial plants and things that make heat. But the graph they used this value scale to demonstrate where the areas were hottest and where the areas were wealthiest.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were two maps of the city, and the one that was recording temperature, low temperatures were pale red and hot temperatures were deep red.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. That's what I would have pictured, yeah.
Yeah. On the SES one, though, very pale colors were a low economic status and high SES was a very deep green.
I see, which also makes sense on its own, yes. But it's confusing when they're next to each other.
Right. And yeah. So I was reading them inversely because I'm an artist and I care about value. And I wasn't making like the assumption about green being money and temperature being hot.
Right. Interesting.
Yeah. But color is the most exciting, so it's like overused and often used poorly. Shape, we don't have an order to, but size, okay. We can use to order things.
We're Americans. The bigger, the better.
So I went to look for like examples of, and I think there's a big push right now as we find ourselves in the midst of an increasingly digital age, there's this push to make increasingly dynamic graphics and three-dimensional visualizations and everything like that. And so there is actually awards for data visualization.
Oh, wow. Cool. Well, I was struck. I don't know if you saw the New York Times article online when the U.S. hit 100,000 corona deaths.
Mm-hmm.
But that one was actually a really striking dynamic data visualization because as you scrolled down, you were reading what the government was doing. It's kind of a timeline of the virus interspersed mm-hmm. with stories of Ooh. Those about those who died. And as you scrolled, when you started, there were only like a few little dots on the screen. But as like the deaths kept mounting, like the screen was increasingly filled with like little black dots, which were people.
Wow.
So by the end, the screen was almost entirely black behind what you were reading.
Wow.
So,
that's
yeah, it was
cool.
Really beautiful and moving.
Yeah. So some of the, so this is the Kantar Information is Beautiful Awards.
Okay.
And several of the ones I came across speak to that sort of aesthetic, this like dynamic, moving artworks as much as they mm-hmm. are representations of data. And so there's a really cool one that remaps the globe in terms of how much light is used at night.
Okay. Wow.
And Cairo is like this huge, massive, glowing mountain.
Oh, it's a nighttime city, huh?
Yeah. Like when you scroll around the world, because it's this three-dimensional thing, so you can scroll around like you would in like Google Maps, right?
Uh-huh.
And the U.S. is bright kind of all over, but comparatively, the mountain that's glowing in Cairo is just multiple times the size of any of the spots that were glowing in the U.S. or glowing in India.
Oh, wow.
So this is an example of one of those exploratory graphs. All it shows us is that this particular area uses a whole lot of light at night. Another really huge mountain was the main port of Iraq. It's just north of Kuwait. Basra, yes.
Oh, interesting.
And you can make lots of assumptions that explain why they're there, right? Why they're so bright. But the graph itself doesn't go into any of that. It's just a demonstration of where these are. So it's raising a whole bunch of questions. It's letting us see relationships between things. But in terms of, I think the explanatory graphs are the ones that tend to be more prone to bias and trying to, that confirming something you already think rather than opening up questions.
Okay.
So you can distort the things that we have access to, right? Like the bar graphs and the scales that we use, right? The length of the bars, right? Something that we understand very intuitively by adjusting what the y-axis on that scale is.
Mm-hmm.
So I saw one graph where they were comparing the number of people who receive welfare benefits to the number of people who have full-time jobs. So the number of people who were on welfare benefits was 108 million, and the number of people with full-time jobs was 102 million.
Oh.
So there are two major things that are wrong with this graph. One, when they count the data that they're representing is a sort of distortion of reality, because when they counted the people who were on welfare, if one person in a house received benefits, they counted every single person who lived in that house as receiving benefits.
Oh, that's unfair.
Right. And they didn't do the inverse for people who had full-time jobs.
Okay.
So say you have a family where there's a mother, a father, they both work full-time, there's two kids, and then maybe like a cousin who had a family situation happen moves in, but they have like food stamps.
Yeah.
That whole family counts as being on welfare.
Oh, no, that's not an accurate measure.
The numbers themselves are wrong. But the other thing that this particular graph did wrong is that in a normal bar graph, you would start that bottom left-hand corner at zero.
Mm.
And this one started it at like 100 million.
Oh.
And so the 102 million looks like this little tiny half inch, and the 108 million looks like it's 3 feet high. And right. It's leaving out 95% of the graph. And so it's making it look like nobody has a job and everybody's on welfare.
Wow. Yeah, you really have to pay attention to the information and design to make sure you're seeing the graph accurately.
So we can talk about the scale of things, the expectations of where we, right? You can do the thing where we tend to think of like pale as nothing and dark as 100%. But if you flip those inversely, then you're misleading. If you flip a graph and put like 2000 at the beginning and 1900 at the end, right? You're sort of, you're creating a downward trajectory instead of an upward trajectory. So there's all kinds of ways that we use these aesthetics as shorthand to tell stories. And if we're not looking closely, they can be really used to mislead us. So,
right. And it relies on cultural knowledge.
Absolutely.
I mean, right. I have two examples in mind. Like I know in Mexico City, like all of the subway stops also had a symbol, because when they created them, there was like a high illiteracy rates in Mexico. So they wanted like people to be able to know where they were going without reading. And the other thing is I watched this documentary about this nuclear mountain in Sweden, and they basically were like burying this nuclear waste, and they wanted to create a sign that said like, don't dig here, that would still be legible like 10,000 years from now. Mm-hmm. So they had to like go through every scenario of like, what is the most universal symbol for like,
for dig?
Don't dig here, death, like skull, you know? So just thinking about how, like, cause you were saying with like, we read, you know, in Western cultures from left to right, like that's knowledge that these graphs are basing the shorthand on.
Yeah.
So very cool.
So that's my art and reality.
Awesome.
I took up way too much time.
It's all right.
Your time.
So I was thinking a lot about the blurred lines between art and reality, and like, how do we tell the difference? And like, so I'm not going to talk about reality television. Don't worry. But I sort of am going to talk about reality television a little bit. So immediately what I kept thinking
of was about Unreal?
No, what's Unreal?
Oh, Unreal is it's a TV show, but it's like a scripted, like really scripted, like about reality TV shows.
Oh.
So the premise is that it's like The Bachelorette, but it's like a fictionalized version, and you get to see all the work the producers do to manipulate all the people.
Oh, cool. Yeah. It's intense. So along those lines, have you seen Truman Show, the 1998 Jim Carrey film?
Oh. I am pretty sure I watched it back in 1998.
Yeah, I mean, me too, but it's always stuck with me. Like, okay. I haven't seen it since.
Okay.
The premise is Jim Carrey's character is the only person in his world who doesn't know that it's a reality show.
Okay.
Right? So, like,
yeah.
He was born into this world. Everyone else is an actor.
Right.
Okay.
Kind of like The Good Place.
Somewhat, yeah, a little bit like that. Yeah, totally. But this, like, mixes entertainment in. Yeah. And I think a part of why I've been thinking about this is because, like, we live in a surveillance culture.
Yeah.
Right? Like, everything is recorded. And they're, like, the deep fakes are becoming, like, more and more realistic. And so, like, it's getting harder to tell, like, what videos have been manipulated and what haven't.
Yeah.
I mean, with photos, that ship has sailed a long time ago, right? With Photoshop. But, like, when video is able to replicate real life so convincingly, I think we're in trouble with conspiracies and everything. So this blurry line made me interested in the use of reality as art or as entertainment.
Okay.
But not in a sense of reality shows, because those are manipulated. Well, I'm gonna talk about two examples that's gonna lead me into, like, a sort of modern where we are now. So I saw a documentary many years ago. It was a 2009 documentary called We Live in Public. And it was about one of the first tech millionaires named Josh Harris. So he created Sudo.com, which was, like, one of the first online networks, actually. Like, they had streaming channels, and this was, like, in the 90s. So this was, like, very early on in the game. And he became really obsessed with, like, live streaming and stuff that, like, seems commonplace now, but at that time was, like, new technology.
Yeah.
So he created this art project called Quiet, We Live in Public, where he took 100 volunteers, artists, museum curators, all of us, like, anyone who volunteered, and had them live in a 3-story loft in New York, and had 110 surveillance videos, like, cameras on them. And he was actually said later he was inspired by The Truman Show. And he said, quote, "Everything is free in his world that he created except your image." And so what he did was people would then watch, like, if, say, you and I were in that loft together, I would watch your channel. I could just sit and watch your channel. Like, what is Hattie up to right now? 24 hours a day. And that happened for a little while, and then it got shut down by the police. And then so what he did in response to this was made another website called weliveinpublic.com, in which it was 24-hour footage of him and his girlfriend in their apartment. So there were, like, multiple, it was supposed to be a 6-month project. And any guesses into what happened?
Just a lot of porn.
Well, she left him. She actually,
because she was like,
I can't be intimate with you in this public setting.
Right.
And so the documentary sort of makes broader points about, like, even though the digital gives us access to real life, it's a very not intimate medium. So, like, it's hard to, and I think we're all experiencing that with all of our Zoom interactions. We're trying to replicate real life, but it's like there's something blocking it. Not to say you can't create intimacy, but
The flip side is, like, we have students showing up to class in bed,
right? So
and that feels way more intimate than I want to be.
Right, exactly. I mean, there are different ways of maybe gaining information, but it's not necessarily one that's for, like, emotional intimacy, maybe.
Fair.
And then, so that was the one example, which I think is sort of like a really early example of thinking about our own lives in relation to surveillance culture. Yeah. He ended up losing all of his money, and I don't know what he does now. But there's a artist collective currently that if you go to u-r-watching.me, so you are watching me.
Okay.
This artist collective called Null, they're like an anonymous artist collective, has taken footage from live cameras all over the world, including like webcams that don't have passwords on them, and has created an algorithm that splices them together in a film you can watch now online.
Wow.
Now, the soundtrack is like found internet sound that is fictionalized, so that isn't random, but what you are seeing is random live footage from places edited to look like a film.
But it's not edited with an editor's eye. It's
no,
edited...
it's a computer algorithm.
Huh.
But my guess, based on what I saw, so I was watching and it sort of opened on a park. And there were kind of nature sounds. So my guess is they've at least categorized the cameras so that the sound somewhat matches. But I saw like a park where people were just like hanging out and there was a fountain. And then I saw like a New York City street shot and then like a house and then the inside of a house and then like a nighttime street. Like,
wow.
It's pretty crazy. And you can go on anytime.
And watch this. How do they get access to all of these security cameras?
Some of them are, I mean, there are websites where you can go look at live cams all over the world. Like, there are public ones of parks and streets, so some of it is that, but they said also some of it is, like, people who had webcams who don't have passwords on them.
That's so creepy.
Like, maybe ours, right? And so what they call this project is, quote, us, meaning, like, you and I and the humanity, as a film, as characters without our knowledge, without our apparent consent. This is how we live now. We allow access to our lives in exchange for a social life, convenience, security. Wow. So it's making a commentary on this like crazy surveillance that we live in.
Yeah, that's terrifying to be able to see how deep into our lives somebody, anybody... anybody, literally anybody could see these.
Yeah, like, I mean, Google recognizes our faces because it uploads our photos. You know, think about how much information can be gleaned from us.
Well, did you read the article? A company in Wisconsin started inserting chips into their employees.
Oh, no.
And it was like, instead of having like an ID badge, they can connect it to their bank account, so their money just goes straight to their bank, and then they can go like to the, what do you call it, where you go eat in the building?
Like a cafeteria. I'm like, cafeteria.
I was trying to think of like the military word for it for some reason.
A mess hall?
Kind of, yeah. But you just like scan the chip and it pays for your food and...
You know, it's maybe, you know, and I mean, I've read similar things like biohackers who like do that to themselves, who then have their whole houses like set up with their own chip because they want to make their lives more easier. I don't know. But anyways, I'm going to end where I started with the Truman Show. Mm-hmm. So based on this state that we live in which we're constantly surveilled, which we have a 24-hour news cycle, which like, there is entertainment based on reality and reality that's based on entertainment, and it gets real confusing, that there's digital surveillance, that we all can be the stars of our own YouTube channel or TikTok channel, that sort of thing. There's something that has popped up in the last 10 years called the Truman Show delusion, where people think that they are in a reality show. And that everyone around them is actors. And it's sort of, you know, a very specific form of often schizophrenia and often comorbid with other psychological illnesses. But there's something now called the Truman Show delusion. And then it makes me think of conspiracy theories and like this idea of crisis actors. I don't know if you've people who like say that certain events didn't happen.
Yeah.
Show like say that they're staged with crisis actors.
Right.
That people paid to act as if they've been shot in a large group shooting or something. So I think that...
Well, when all of the information we're getting may or may not be true.
Right. And we're going to have to either learn how to... And I think yours speaks to this, too. Like, we need to really learn how to read information or we're fucked. So, that's, art and reality.
Awesome.
The reality is we're fucked.
We're fucked.
Sorry, Mom. We are so excited to have Andy with us here today.
Yeah, my name is Andy Sarjahani. I'm a documentary filmmaker and photographer. I was based in Austin for the past 5 years and recently relocated to East Tennessee. I've worked on several feature docs. Probably the most notable is Tower, which was shortlisted for an Oscar and won South by Southwest in 2016. And you can watch it on Netflix now. It's about the first school shooting in U.S. history. And then I've directed and produced a handful of documentaries myself, documentary shorts. The most recent played at several festivals throughout the U.S. The name of it is Horns Out. And it's about a 77-year-old mountaineer in Montana and kind of his relationship to aging and his the loss of his childhood ranch, and he kind of works through some deeper questions that to be honest with you, while we were filming it, it was evident that, you know, there were some questions he probably hadn't even asked himself in decades. So he was kind of dealing with some existential stuff that we all have or will deal with at some point. So yeah, I've also done documentary photo essays and did one a year or two ago that was published in Vice on the last days of Toys R Us. And
that one like hit me in the feels, you know. Like, well, I mean, your childhood? I don't know. I went to Toys R Us all the time.
I don't know if I've ever been to a Toys R Us.
I don't know. It was just like, it was like the death of my generation's childhood in a way.
I mean, the nearest Toys R Us to where I grew up was probably like a 4-hour drive.
Oh, okay. So that was a deal. It was a big deal for where I grew up too, because it wasn't that far. It was like an hour and 15 minutes. So it was like a deal. You got to go on your birthday. You got like a $5 bill. It was like an experience. So yeah, that was a fun project to work on.
Yeah. When I think you really captured like both the childhood excitement and the sort of death of that, as well as critiquing this large corporations, like there was an interesting mix of things you did with that photo essay that I think were really cool.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. We were very fortunate in the access that we got. We kind of had uninhibited full tilt access for multiple days, and which is rare to get, you know. The manager just happened to be a really cool guy and opened up the store, and it worked out really well. So yeah, that was a lot of fun to shoot, and it was pretty bleak too, just seeing all that.
How do you pick these topics? There's a wide range, it seems, in the material that you document. So how do you go about sort of figuring out what stories you want to follow?
Sure, that's a good question. I think a couple of things probably off the top of my head. There's more, I'm sure, but I think the two biggest are what pulls at you, like what it's more than it, you can probably tell a piece of work that the filmmaker or photographer didn't kind of just did for work, or the kind that they did because they connected with it. For me, I think it's just like there's something there that I have to connect with. So for the Horns Out, the documentary about the climber, the mountaineer, you know, I'm a climber myself. I lived in Montana. He was actually a climbing partner of mine. Toys R Us.
Cool.
Toys R Us, you know, it was just like a big part of my childhood. And I'm also particularly fascinated with just the retail apocalypse and in America and our kind of obsession with box stores and what that means for our landscape. So there has to be something you connect with, and you kind of know when you connect with it, because it, you know, it kind of just grabs you by the shirt and yanks you in, you know. And then it's also access too, which is the big is huge, you know. So you have to, I mean, there's a lot of things we can connect with every day or you want to do something on, but you know, you have to be able to have access. And so that's a big one too. And then just being able to, you know, I think this is something I'm still figuring out personally. And I guess everybody, you know, is kind of on their own journey, but it's also how, you know, how invested do you want to get in each thing, right? So like there's a difference between, you know, a short documentary and a photo essay and a feature documentary. And I guess obviously for the purposes of this podcast, you know, I understand you guys speak to artists of all mediums, but I can only grasp, you know, the film and photographer documentarian's perspective. So that's what I'm kind of speaking from. But yeah, it's there's a certain level of investment that goes with everything too. So you might find something that's like, hey, this is really cool. This is really interesting. I have access. But, you know, to make that what it would need to be, you know, that would need, you know, I think that's, you know, that's like a 3 or 4 year investment. Or or, you know, this is, I can go and shoot this for a month and, you know, edit for a month or two and make a short doc and it's great. So it kind of just depends on, you know, what you're, you know, and I think that those, the special projects, at least from my perspective, I have not directed and produced a feature of my own yet. But those are kind of the ones that are like, those are like the unicorns, because this really is like an undertaking. I mean, you kind of have to expect to dedicate day one to like distribution day for a feature. You can, I mean, it's 5 years typically. Most of the filmmakers I know, I think you can do them in like 3, but you know, anything less than I'm sure there are people who have done them, you know, in 6 months. I wouldn't doubt that, but it's just a long-term labor of love.
It seems too, even if the people in charge are giving you access, one of the challenges is finding the right people to feature. There's like that long, I don't know, I grew up with this joke that whenever there's like some crisis on local news, the person that they get to interview is like just the loudest, dumbest person. And so you're negotiating people who have the will to just be loud and say their piece, but also like, do they have actual knowledge about what's going on? And so how do you find the right people?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I think it depends on the subject, and you know, you really have to be thoughtful about, you know, from a documentary perspective, you know, how you're portraying these people, because I mean, this is like an ongoing battle, an ongoing discussion in the documentary and in journalism world, about, you know, just exploitation and representation. There's obviously more room for interpretation and conceptual ideas in the documentary world from the journalism world. I think they're two very different directions. I would find myself more in the documentary world.
Can you go into that just a little bit more? Like, what would you say are the differences?
Sure. I mean, well, from my perspective only, I think journalism is just it's a rigorous profession, and they have a set of standards and code that they adhere to, which is what makes a democracy. I mean, they're so important to a democracy, and it's a little bit more of a journalistic style film is a little bit more investigative. The filmmaker has to at all costs, you know, do his or her best to keep their own perspectives and opinions out of it. Whereas I think documentary, it can be more conceptual and it's almost an artistic interpretation of the subject. My favorite documentarian, Errol Morris, he did a film called The Thin Blue Line in 1986. And it actually got a man off of death row in Texas. He did a lot of investigation for it, but it was also not very, he used a lot of journalistic practices, you know, to get to the questioning, the research, the reporting, et cetera, but what he did in The Thin Blue Line was very controversial at the time for documentary. He recreated scenes cinematically with actors and whatnot. And that was like kind of breaking this documentary taboo in 1986 because it was like,
no longer like cinema verite, right?
It exactly.
was like, let's, yeah.
Exactly. Like Maisel's brothers, those guys were like the masters of verite cinema. You know, the Gimme Shelter, The Salesman, Grey Gardens, those guys are fantastic at that. But the I feel like documentary is almost kind of errs more towards the conceptual, whereas journalistic is to like, here's the facts. You need to know this information. Whereas documentary can be a little bit more ethereal.
So this gives you more freedom to choose the people you like and who are interesting.
Yeah.
Well, but I think what Andy does really well is present people that are maybe not always shown or maybe are stereotyped and presents them with a very like intimate and human lens. And I think you do that on all sides of the argument. So maybe I'm getting this from, you wrote an essay about like being from like the rural South and being Iranian and how you balance those two things, right? Like, I feel like your shots in Iran and then your shots of like Southern life show a humanity to both sides of the coin where like somebody else might think they're the enemy. Does that make sense what I'm trying to say? Like, how do you have such an unjudgmental lens?
Man, well, thank you. I'm glad that you see that when you see those images. I just think it's empathy. You kind of like with whoever you're shooting, it's important to have that. I think we all like insert ourselves and our perspectives onto our images. Like that's unavoidable. But, I guess I think just having empathy and that's like kind of a constant work in progress. So
then how do we cultivate empathy particularly in this moment?
I don't know. That's a big question beyond this podcast.
Can you solve the world's problems?
Yeah. So yeah. How do we fix the world?
Man. Yeah, that's.
It seems like when you set out on a documentary, you have a certain perspective on because you've received a certain amount of information. So how often do you go into a documentary thinking one thing and then come out thinking something totally different? Or what is that process like?
Yeah, I mean, I think that can totally happen. I mean, I think I don't know that I've had anything like any huge curveballs in the projects that I've directed and produced, but it does happen. And an example of that there's a documentary in Errol Morris again. He did a film called Vernon, Florida in 1982, and it's about a small town on the Florida Panhandle. He started out the film. It was originally supposed to be called Nub City, and it was about this town in Florida had the highest rate of amputees in America. And he, through his investigation, found out that people were amputating their own limbs for insurance settlements. And so he was making a film about that.
Whoa.
And they found out, and he got a lot of death threats because he was going to blow their cover. So he ended up completely abandoning that idea. And it was just a quirky enough town that he could still make an interesting – it's a fantastic film, interesting film. And he just called it Vernon, Florida. named after the town. And it's an amazing, amazing documentary. So I think that that definitely happens. It, and especially with any kind of like investigative work, I think that that's, you can always kind of, I haven't made a deeply investigative film yet. My first film was, there was some stuff. And
it wasn't, didn't you have some controversy with, downstream people?
Yeah. So that was about, that was a film. It's a mid-length documentary about an industrial hog farm built in Newton County, Arkansas, right on the Buffalo National River. It's the first national river in America. Newton County, Arkansas also happens to be, I believe, I don't know where it's at now. At the time, I believe it was the sixth poorest county in the state of Arkansas, which is, you know, probably the third poorest state in the union. And so I had originally been drawn to that idea because this was like 60 or 70 miles up the road from where I grew up. It's, you know, very attached to the National River. But as I kind of got into it, what I realized was that was kind of the bigger issue was that this was a low-income community's watershed that had basically just been dumped on by Cargill. It was owned by Cargill at the time, which has been sold a couple times since, in collaboration with the state government, who kind of turned a blind eye for, you know, that, you know, economic benefits. So I kind of set out in more of a, you know, kind of a conservation based film was the, kind of the original idea. And that shifted more to more of a, you know, an environmental justice, social justice, concept as I kind of got deeper and deeper into it and kind of realized like, okay, like this is much more about like, it's very easy. You know, everyone was kind of on the bandwagon of protecting the river, the National River, which is, I am fully on board with and fully support and agree with, but nobody was really talking about the low-income community that was just completely being exploited here. And partially because the low-income community wanted the hog farm there. They oftentimes you'll see that, you know, they kind of vote against their own best interest because they have, you know, their only other job opportunity is $8 an hour at Dollar General. Right. Well, you know, if they, and that hog farm only provided six jobs paying $13 an hour, and they only generated $13,000 a year in tax revenue. So it wasn't quite what they sold it out to be, but, there weren't too many people speaking out about like, hey, this is a watershed of a very poor population. Everybody was kind of more on board with protecting the river. So that I would say that was definitely a change from what I had originally set out to make.
And how was it received? Like, do you share the final work with the people you interview, or what are some of the ways you share the work after it's made?
Yeah, sure. So I typically, the main characters, people that were, you know, main characters in the film, I would always want them to see more or less final cut, let them know how they're going to be represented.
What if they say like, no, I don't, this is wrong.
Yeah, that's a tough one. It hasn't happened to me. And I think if it were, I think it would have to be a case by case basis. That's so hard because I haven't had that personally happen. That's also why you get a release. You know, when you film in the beginning, you're like, hey, like, because it's a tough thing as a documentary filmmaker, right? So like, from a documentary filmmaker's perspective, like we don't make much money. Like, it's non-profit in the negative, you know, in a lot of ways, but you're investing your time and your money, just pouring your heart and soul into this project. And you it's an agreement between you and the subjects, like, hey, like, I'm making this film, you know that I'm running the camera, and anything you, by signing this release, you basically are agreeing to appearing in the film as you present yourself. If you, whatever you say off the camera, like that obviously I won't, would never, you know, you would never record anybody without their permission or share anything right. that they shared off the film. But if they said something that can make or break the film, like, you know, just an incredible, powerful line. And they came back and said, you know, hey, I don't want this in the film. It's, you know, I hope I'm never in that position. I hope I'm never in that position. But, you know, I think you'd have to think about their reasoning. I mean, that's a case by case basis because, you know, Yossi, like I was working on a film in Iran. I was working on two features there. And, you know, one of them was about a female rock climber and her kind of dual existence in the city in Tehran and in the mountains where she climbed without hijab. Now, in a situation like that, you know, where someone could be thrown in jail for the rest of their life, if, you know, they were uncomfortable with something, you certainly want to be sensitive to, you don't want to do anything that's going to get your subjects harmed or in
unless Carol Baskin says her husband is buried in the backyard.
But I mean, I guess it if any material would put the subject in harm, then that is something that you would really have to consider. But I think that's like the tricky thing about documenting real life, because you want to tell the story in a specific way, right? With your spin, but at the same time, like, you have to honor reality. So like, how do you balance your viewpoint with like, quote unquote, objective reality, which I don't think exists as I asked that question.
Yeah. I mean, that's a good one. Honestly, like, I think that that's a case by case basis. And I don't fashion myself a journalist. So I don't want to be held to that, you know, strict rigor of like falling into like, cause like I have the utmost respect for them and the work that they do. It's a kind of a case by case basis. And I think my interests vary. So like, I guess I can weigh two different, you know, a project I was working on versus a project I'm planning for now, both short documentaries. The first was a short documentary about a man in the Ozarks. His name is Joseph, and he's originally from New Orleans. Then in 1999, he had a painting commissioned for the rebranding of Jesus Christ for the new millennium. For the Vatican was having a contest, and the painting's incredibly striking.
Wow. Wait, so the Vatican had a contest?
I have not been able to find a contest on the internet. but the painting is of Jesus in a spacesuit in outer space holding a globe like this, and it says, "I'm not of this world, follow me." So he claims that painting finished in the top 10 in the world. He also claims that he was the PR director for the construction of the New Orleans Superdome, and he did, the vision for the Superdome came to him when he was 8 years old. Three celestial beings without feet brought him the vision. They told him he was going to build the greatest building since the Great Pyramids. And it was going to be in, a golden mushroom at the end of Poydras Street, the Street of Dreams. And so, I filmed with him a couple times. He's also a part of a religious group called Urantia, which very strangely believe that Persians are a super race. This is
what?
Yeah. This is talking about access, you know, like that's part of why my access was so good. Cause he claims that in looking at you, he would say the same thing. We have a violet aura, which signifies royalty according to him. Obviously anytime you're talking about super races, it's problematic. And so, I'm assuming he probably won't hear this out there, but I was making this. I had done a shoot with him, and it was going to be a fun conceptual piece, just kind of a quirky Ozarks. His property is really beautiful and scenic. He's got a waterfall on it. He's built a little temple on his property that's like – temple is like a very – is quite an overstatement, but it's still interesting to know that he thinks of it as a temple. It was just going to be an interesting exploration into kind of like what we believe that we tell ourselves, you know? And then I was headed to go to New Orleans this past May. And we had a conversation, and he had made some comments the last time I was filming with him that, you know, like one of them was, I'm sorry, you guys get confused with Arabs all the time. Like, you guys bred them to be your worker race. Yeah. I was headed from Chattanooga to New Orleans, and then I was going to go up to film him again for another shoot. And this was not long after the George Floyd murder. And he, I called him, and he started talking to me about how basically things would have just been better if we would have sent all the slaves back to Liberia because they can't coexist in our society, as is evidenced by the riots. And he compared the protesters to ISIS for tearing down statues and so on and so forth. And I was just, so that film, you know, I took you kind of down the progression of how these things happen. I made the decision to either nix or put that one on indefinite pause. I don't know that the world needs a film about, you know, a racist that doesn't know he's racist, you know? Like right now, it just doesn't seem appropriate. Maybe there will be a time for it. And if there is, then I have access to one. But it's
maybe we'll be looking back on like how far we've come as a country, and this will be a film that will be emblematic of the time when we were lost.
Maybe so. Maybe so. At any rate, it doesn't feel right to invest my time and energy into like giving this person, you know, a platform right now. So but all that to say, I would like to compare that, you know, this quirky, what was originally supposed to be a fun, quirky piece to the, I'm working on now. I'm developing a short film about a young black farmer couple outside of New Orleans, and that lost their land. And they were actually featured in the New York Times 1619 podcast. I don't know if you guys have listened to that. But in any, like, black farmers in America have lost, like in the 20th century, lost 12 million acres through legal land theft, you know, like denial of loans, half rate loan or loans that were basically half the amount they needed to run their farm, delayed loans to the point to where they couldn't get the loan until a month after planting time, to where they actually couldn't get a successful crop in. So technically legal ways, but it was like a great way for the white banker to hold up the black farmer in a way that he or she would lose their farm, and then a white farmer could swoop in and reclaim it. And then you have one less black farmer to deal with in your community.
It's terrible.
And it's insane. But I'm doing a film with them, which will probably be a short piece. And they've been covered extensively. They haven't been covered post-pandemic or post-racial unrest in this country. And so they're kind of on a new chapter. And we've had phone conversations, exchanged several emails. They're very eager. They've seen both of my films and feel comfortable working with me. So that's going to be a much different film. They're living out in New Iberia, Louisiana, which is like, if you've ever seen True Detective, that's like Yellow King country. So it's probably not ideal, you know, to be a black person in that part of Louisiana. And it's a difficult situation. So I have a tremendous amount of, you know, responsibility to, you know, in terms of representation and telling their story in a way that honors them.
That's awesome. Cool. And I mean, I think that's just really cool too, how you're using your platform to honor the voices that you feel are important in this moment. So I think that's really cool.
Yeah, this feels like a good trade.
Yeah. How did you get started in all of this? Like,
in did you documentary?
Study it in school? Or, yeah.
Yeah. Like, well, what's your origin story? My master's degree is in sustainable agriculture and food systems, which is part of my connection to the Black Farmer film. But my second semester in graduate school, I read an article about a dairy farmer in the New York. I read this article in the New York Times, a dairy farmer that methodically shot all 51 of his cows in the head and then shot himself and left a note. And I remember there was obviously, I think, mental health issues there, but there was also, it was also just under the weight of the dairy industry. So, which is an incredibly difficult, I mean, farming in general in America is difficult, but dairy farming is like a next level beast for a lot of reasons. You're very isolated. You're very attached to the land. Like, you have to milk those cows 2 or 3 times a day, 7 days a week. Like, you're chained to that piece of land. Their prices, the dairy farmer prices at the time hadn't really changed for the farmer since 1980. This was 2010. Wow. So things were tough for the dairy farmer. And I remember thinking a peer-reviewed journal article, which was what I was in academia for, just like would not have the impact that a film would on this guy. Mm-hmm. Like, you could show me all the stats you want mm-hmm. to try to convince me that dairy farming needs restructuring in America, or you could just show this story. And I think that would have a greater impact. I didn't know anything about making films. I reached out to every MFA student at Montana State University. One girl responded, and she won a student Emmy, and we'd exchanged several emails, and then she and her partner got pregnant, and so her priorities changed and never really left me. I think that's kind of when the bug hit. It was like, okay, like, this is a medium worth considering, you know. My graduate degree was paid for, so I loved what I was doing, but I finished it, and but that bug never left me, and so I left that and became a. I knew I wanted to become a documentary filmmaker, but I didn't know how. I didn't want to go back to school. I became.
I hear that.
I think 4 degrees total. So I was like, I can't, no more. So I became a mechanic in nuclear plants to pay the bills. I do that 2 months in the spring, 2 months in the fall, and I moved to
Austin.
And
you still do that, yeah?
I still do that, yeah. Okay. And it kind of takes care of the financial burden, and then I have the other 8-ish months to do what I really love to do.
How do I become a mechanic in a nuclear plant?
I don't know that it's, man.
I don't think I have that skill set.
Believe it or not, I think some of the stuff a highly trained monkey could do, because it's just stuck in the 70s. But so yeah, I did that, and I moved to Austin and got in and just started working on bigger projects. And I found, you know, the first project that I wanted to make, and it kind of never left me. And so I've just kept making ever since, and trying to learn as much as I can, and trying to put myself in workshops and different, you know, peer learning opportunities are great. And that is one thing that school is worth, you know. But yeah, that's kind of how I got into all of it.
Awesome. Well, it's about time for our provocation. So, sound effect. What are you going to challenge us to do?
Okay. This is really simple, and it's a fun
Great.
One.
Somebody hear that.
I challenge people to take pictures of people wearing red and black plaid in public.
Okay, you know what? If we hadn't run out of time right now, I'm just about to ask you what that was about on your Instagram. So I love that this is the provocation, because that was a question I had. So what's the provocation? We take photos of people in red and black plaid?
Take photos of people in red and black plaid. You can send them to me if you want. I have an Instagram called People Wearing Red and Black Plaid. Awesome. I haven't been active on it, but I have probably 1,500 photos of people wearing red and black plaid, and it's fascinating. So the thing that's great about it is you see it everywhere. I mean, I've seen it in Tehran, Mexico City, Philadelphia, the grocery store in rural Oklahoma, everywhere. And it's like kind of this like common denominator of humanity that I've noticed, and it's everywhere, and you're kind of always on a treasure hunt. And it's like also a challenge to get like a picture on the sly. And it's, I'm a big fan of street photography too. And so it's, Yeah, it's like gives you something to kind of constantly be on the lookout for.
Like, and where's Waldo?
Exactly. Cool. Where's exactly. And once you see it, you can't unsee it. This is true.
It's a long walk.
This is true. But
two my coolest challenges ever.
but you will also see it in ads. You'll see it in movies. You'll see it in TV shows. It's in, you know, like I.
Does that count?
Well, now it does during a pandemic.
So I can take a picture of like my TV screen.
Totally. Yeah, I took a picture of. I was watching Reality Bites a while back, and you know, somebody in Reality Bites is wearing a red and black plaid. I took a picture of that. Laura Dern wears a red and black plaid shirt and blue velvet.
Cool.
You'll see it. You'll see it in advertisements. There's a Hulu ad out now with somebody in red and black plaid.
Awesome. But what's so you're attracted to it because it's the common denominator of humanity. It's humanity's shared fabric, if you will.
I think so. Yeah. That's kind of my theory on it. I think it's because it's something one day in Philadelphia, I'll never forget. I saw a white woman probably in her late 70s, early 80s wearing it. And that night in a punk club, I saw a young black man wearing the exact same shirt. And it was like this, you know, it's kind of just this common thread of humanity, and you can almost, it's like a common denominator. That's the way I like to think of it. And especially in the times we're living in, maybe it's just like this like temporary escape.
Well, we need something to bring us together.
I can say with 100% certainty that I do not own anything that is red and black plaid.
Well, you better get on it. I now have a red and black plaid mask my girlfriend got for me.
That's awesome. That's awesome.
There is a very high chance that I will catch Joel wearing red and black plaid, though.
Okay, there you go. Your assignment's easy.
Yeah. I'll just go into his closet and be like, hey, put this on.
Yeah. Oh, this shirt looks nice on you. Here, wear this.
Yeah.
Take a slide photo. All right. Well, awesome. Thank you so much. It was really great.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
I'm excited for the work coming out for sure.
Yeah.
Keep us in the loop.
You guys keep doing good work. Keep me posted on things.
Cool.
It was fun.
All right.
That was awesome. Thank you so much, Andy.
And thanks everyone for joining us once again. If you want to know more about anything we talked about in today's episode, make sure to check out the show notes.
And do the provocation. This one is easy and feels like a Where's Waldo surge.
It's so fun.
Yeah, so if you see someone wearing red and black plaid, preferably in person, but since we're all in some form of shelter in place, TV is fine too, send it our way. Tag us at hashtag ArtIfPodcast and tag the Instagram account at people wearing red and black plaid.
Next week, our gallery topic is art and the city, and we'll be interviewing painter and ceramic artist Tom Draculich.
I know we said this earlier, but if you like this podcast, just hit subscribe, please. We don't ask much of you. And rate and review us. 5 stars. Tell people you like the show.
See you next week. No. We'll see you in 2 weeks.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Art If Podcast is produced by
Hattie Cry
and Yasi Jahanmir.
Our theme music was composed by Muhammad Abdul Salam.
Follow us at Art If Podcast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook to stay up to date on upcoming episodes and to join our vibrant community of artists.